Calling all Brooklyn moms, JOMA presents an evening of nutrition for moms and kids. On May 22nd at 8 p.m., learn helpful tips and tricks for preparing nutritious food for you and your family with Dr. Marina Klotzman and JOMA's Wellness Director, Julie Wilcox. The cost is $18 and the address will be provided upon registration. Register on our website, www.joma.org. We look forward to seeing you there.
Welcome to the JOMA podcast, presented by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. Every week, hear from expert medical professionals as they share up-to-date insights on health topics to help you live your best life physically, mentally, and emotionally. Join us as we navigate the ever-changing landscape of healthcare and strive to improve the health of the Orthodox Jewish community.
Hi, welcome to the JOMA podcast. I'm your host, Jenny Berkovich, board-certified pediatrician and JOMA's Director of Education. Today's episode is with guest Dr. Allison Escalante, and we talk all about the Schutz storm. If you don't know what the Schutz storm is, you're definitely going to want to hear this episode. Dr. Escalante is a pediatrician and author of the book, Sci C Start, How to Be the Parent Your Child Needs in a World That Won't Stop Pushing. She is a writer and woman on a mission to ease the epidemic of anxiety that has convinced us we are always failing and is stealing our joy. She has developed a three-step method to help parents raise their kids mindfully, skillfully, and enjoy doing it. And you better believe I had her walk me through all the steps. She's a contributor to Forbes and Psychology Today, as well as a TEDx speaker. Her website is sciccstart.com. She has a degree from Princeton University, as well as Rutgers, and did her pediatric training at Duke and University of Chicago. She's an adjunct member of faculty at the Rush University School of Medicine. Hi, Dr. Escalante, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Ever since I heard about your book and had your work on my radar, I've been dying to talk to you. So I'm really excited to get this conversation going. It always fascinates me anytime, really any physician writes a book, but a pediatrician writing a book just absolutely blows my mind because I feel like, you know, so much of general pediatrics is us having this like unique vantage point, right? Of seeing kids when they're healthy and talking a lot about prevention, and certainly parenting and guiding parents is a big part of that. I feel like so many people in our field wish they could just like record themselves and just like hit play because we say so many things over and over. So I kind of understand where one would want to write a book, but it just seems like such a daunting task. So first off, I guess, what was the impetus? Like, why did you even decide like you wanted to write a book specifically about parenting?
So many ways I could answer that question. I mean, it starts with the fact that when I was young, I never expected to grow up to be a doctor. I expected to grow up to be a writer. Then I turned out to be good at science, and then I thought it was really great. And in my undergraduate years, I actually studied what's called intellectual and cultural history. So it's basically the history of ideas and how ideas actually move through cultures and create change. And also what a culture is, because a lot of what a culture is a list of things that we take for granted and that we take to be true. And we often don't think to examine to see, well, is that really true? You know, and so it's just a fascinating thing to study. And it was really great practice for medicine because, you know, there's no better training for taking a really good history than being a history major. But then I got out into my pediatric practice and I was just amazed by how worried parents were, all the little things they worried about, especially because I had come straight out of the ICU. So there it was like everything was life or death, like literally. And then you get out and parents are worried about a tiny sniffle. And this was before COVID made that like a reasonable thing to worry about, right? Or they're worried about a child who's clearly developing normally, but they're concerned they're not optimizing that development enough and in ways. And when I started to recognize that this seemed to be across the board, this wasn't one parent or two parents, right? This was everybody. And then not long after I had my first child and was hit by an extreme, like, oh my gosh, how am I going to do this? That same culture of worry really hit me too. I said, well, wait a minute. something's going on here at a cultural level. And so I started thinking about that, and I spent years I started out looking for the book to give my patients, right? That's what I was trying to do. Like, hey, the book to give people to help, because in a 15-minute visit, I can't counsel people through this level of worry, right? Or the nuances here. And I think so much of the drive was that sense that we can't really have the level of nuanced or in-depth conversation I want in a 15-minute appointment, but we can do it in a book. So when I couldn't find the book I was looking for, in fact, what I found instead was most of the books gave parents a big, long list of all the things they should do. You should do this, you should do that. Reading them myself, even with the vantage point of a pediatrician, knowing that much of that advice was, some was good, some was bad. Yeah. But I still felt intense anxiety just reading them as a mom, because, you know, the idea that if you don't do it right, you're going to mess up your kid for life is terrifying. And that's really the cultural message right now. So eventually I realized I was going to have to write my own book because I couldn't find what I was looking for.
Do you find, and certainly with your perspective, having studied sort of the history of this, do you find that this constant criticism and pressure, you know, that parents are faced with today, is this a new phenomenon, or has there always been a component of this historically in parenting?
This is not new, but there are elements of it that are new. So one of the critical shifts that happened in modern history was actually not documented in my book. It's in Screaming on the Inside by Jessica Gross. And she talks about how about 200 years ago, there began to be a move towards scientific motherhood. The idea that instead of having many kids and you're too busy working on your farm to worry about the safety of those kids, so some survive and that's in God's hands, suddenly it switched to this idea that there should be some deliberate parenting and there's a scientific way to do it and you need expert advice in order to do that. And then there were a number of steps historically that led to greater intensification of that. But, you know, by the beginning of the 20th century, the message that mothers are completely responsible for how their kids turn out, dads actually used to be held more responsible than they are now. Now it's around the earliest 20th century, the pressure landed solely on mothers. And the idea that not only are they fully responsible, but they're also not truly competent to do it. They need expert intervention to do that. And then basically, I think there was a big change that was really important in the 90s, which was when attachment parenting caught on. And attachment parenting is deceptive because at first it looks really loving, right? You know, the idea is you stay close to your child, and you soothe them and you meet their needs, right? And that's wonderful. But what in practice, what the attachment parenting proponents pushed was this super intensive, stressful version of parenting. And they claimed it was based on science. And in fact, it was not based on science whatsoever. And they even the scientific studies were actually like they were studying attachment in kids, which is that sense of security a child has with their parent, that sense of safety and security in the relationship that really is very important. So they started studying that in the 60s and 70s. And what they found is, you know, you can make a lot of mistakes and it's fine, you know, right? But that's not. And so the attachment parenting movement took that word and created this pseudoscience appearance that this incredibly intensive, like you have to wear your baby all the time. You have to be 100% in sync with them. It was impossible for any mom who needed to work. And we know 70% of moms need to work in this country, right? So not everyone has a choice to stay home. And that was the beginning of what we now call intensive parenting, which is the version of parenting that is everywhere now. And the name of the hot new trend keeps changing every 5 to 10 years or so. But that's what it is. The idea that, children are fragile and easily breakable, and that we have to intensively optimize them and develop them up. And as pediatricians, we know that a certain amount of tension and care and nurture is very important as a parent, but also kids have a normal developmental trajectory. And a lot of that they're going to do naturally. They don't need us to be meddling all the time.
So I recognize a degree of almost danger with all these different paradigms, right? Like you have to do this, you have to wear them, and you have to this, and you have to meddle, and you have to be right, very intense or whatever. In your book, you sort of, I think, introduced me to this concept of a should storm. So what's that? What's the should storm, and how do you see it like actually practically impacting parents today?
That's my shorthand for this culture, right? You should do this, you should do that. You should definitely never do that other thing. You make the slightest mistake, you're going to mess up your kid for life. And it's both an external culture that really is present the moment we consider getting pregnant. But it's also something we internalize. So we have a voice running in our head of constant criticism. And sometimes those are voices we've heard, like our auntie saying, "How could you let the baby cry like that?" Right? Like for 2 seconds. Or, you know, those shaming voices. And what's interesting is the claim of the should storm is that you need to do this to be a good parent and to make sure your child is securely in a healthy relationship with you. And yet this very act and this very should storm of like trying to get it right all the time actually interferes with that healthy relationship. So parents become stressed and distracted by the shoulds rather than achieving the goal that we have as loving parents, which is to actually have that secure, comforting, meaningful relationship with our kids.
The title of your book, which is Sci C Start, is this like three-step method that you introduce. So can you walk me a little bit through those three steps and how it sort of aims to overcome this should storm?
That's right, because this is such a powerful culture. And especially as women, it's something that is an outgrowth of the culture of being a woman in the first place, right? We have a lot of shoulds on us as women. And so we're trained to think this way. And so it's all well and good to tell people like, "Hey, are you noticing this about this culture?" And like I was, you know, people will have aha moments, but you're not going to be able to actually parent in a countercultural way if you don't have a tool, right? Otherwise, we're just going to say, "Oh, there's this should storm," but how do we discern what we need to do and what steps we need to take? How do we free ourselves from that? So that's where Sci C Start came from. The other thing is, as a pediatrician, I'm a bottom line person. You know, it's too complicated to have 14,000 steps to perfect parenting, right? Like we need something we can use when we're tired, when we're, you know, busy, when we don't have the bandwidth to really think things through at a deep level.
Which is probably the overwhelming majority of like parents,
right?
Basically on a day to day, right? Like very few people have the luxury to sit and say, "Okay, here's a stressful moment. And how am I going to use whatever should storm, right? Or whatever paradigm they align themselves to at that moment, how am I going to use that to overcome this?" I find that most parenting is exactly what you just described, when you're stressed, when you're tired, when you're triggered, and the same goes for your kids. So I do think it's important to sort of recognize that as not being an outlier situation. It's kind of the default.
And, you know, I actually know moms, especially those who have academic degrees, who have tried to look up the correct should for every situation, right? And boy, are they, those poor moms, they are driving themselves crazy. And then you feel like this tremendous failure, because when those high pressure times comes, guess what doesn't work? That should you looked up, you know?
Right.
So Sci C Start, the subtitle is How to Be the Parent Your Child Needs in a World That Won't Stop Pushing. And I think that really encapsulates what this method helps us do. It's simple. It's easy to remember. It works. It's something to use under pressure. But also, if you have time to think about your parenting, it can be used in a strategic way. and it's based in science. So do you remember in kindergarten when your teacher taught you what to do if your clothes caught on fire?
Stop, drop, and roll.
Stop, drop, and roll. So if your emotions are on fire as a parent, you're feeling those shoulds or you're feeling anxious because you're unsure of what to do, then we sigh, see, and start. So sigh starts with the only breathing method I know that is naturally built into our system already. There's lots of great breathing methods that help us pause, that help us center and connect with our bodies. But sighing is something we do naturally. And a lot of parents have told me, hey, doc, I can remember that. I sigh at my kids anyway. I'm like, that's right. So when you sigh at your kids, this time, instead of sighing in exasperation, see if you can turn it into a sigh of relief. And so when we sigh, we take that deep breath into the body. But more importantly, a sigh is characterized by the long, slow out breath. And it's that long, slow out breath that actually sends a message to our nervous system. For you as a pediatrician, to our autonomic nervous system, it actually increases the tone of the vagus nerve, which sends our body a message, you're safe. It's okay to connect socially. And what's really interesting is all this high pressure parenting we do is really, you know, the emotion that goes with it is stress and anxiety. And when that's our emotion, the neurological state we're in is fight or flight. So when we're in fight or flight, our sympathetic nerve is activated. And guess what the brain does? It turns off the two key areas of the brain that we want to be great parents, because in fight or flight, to be prepared to say fight a lion or something, you don't need those. So our prefrontal cortex is shut down because we don't need to have our critical thinking and our wise thinking online. And our emotional centers are shut down. So one of the classic neurology jokes is there's no sympathy in sympathetic tone. You can't sympathize with your kids when you're feeling that anxiety. So when we sigh with that long, slow out breath, now we are telling our nervous system, you can shift into out of fight or flight into the safe and social nervous system. And you can turn back on those areas, that part that allows you to think wisely and that part that allows you to connect emotionally. And that's huge.
So that's the sigh part, right?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking practically this makes sense during an acute situation, right? Something that's happening, that's upsetting, that you possibly need to intervene at. How does this work during just regular parenting, regular interaction? Is there a place for that?
Absolutely. Because the reality is that as Americans, especially, you know, we are trained to be fixers, right? Get in there and fix it. And if we are interacting with our kids from that template, we're going to be missing the real power of parenting. So sighing allows us to stop and connect with ourselves first, to regulate our bodies, so that we can be ready to connect with our kids. Generally, if we don't sigh, we're just going to be running on those shoulds. We tend to automatically just react to the should. So even if we're feeling fine, we might be shoulding on our kids and missing a real opportunity.
Okay, that makes sense. So, okay, that's step one. So step two is C.
Mm-hmm. So C.
So how does that work?
Yeah, C is your moment of mindfulness. And so when you see, you're going to take a look at your child. You're going to see your child, see the situation, right? So instead of just reacting to those shoulds, we're getting into the present and really noticing what's going on. Now, I chose the word see because it's an alliteration. Sigh, see, start. It makes it easier to remember. But I don't mean vision alone. And I don't want to leave out any parent who is visually impaired, right? This is about noticing. And this is about noticing mindfully, which is really hard for Western parents because we're action oriented, right? And mindful noticing means that you're paying attention, but you're not immediately making a decision or trying to do something yet. So that's what they mean when they say you're not judging yet. It doesn't mean that as parents, we don't make judgments. I mean, that's half the job is discerning what's the best thing to do here. But it means that you're taking this moment to see and gather that information, the body language, the environment, the situation. Do you have a kid with sensory sensitivities? And as you see, you notice that there's loud construction equipment going on outside. Maybe that's factoring into why your child is acting irritable or defiant in that moment, because they're stressed by that, right? So this is the kind of information that we can take in when we mindfully see.
Okay, so we have the pause that we're doing with the sign. We have the see where we're evaluating the situation and the surroundings to gather more information to sort of give us insight into what's going on. So now let's do the final step, which is the action step, which is start.
And this is where this method gets different from other parenting methods, because there are a lot of really great advice parenting methods out there that involve a breathing pause and a mindful moment. But start is where you really know this book was written by a pediatrician, because start is where we start to use the scientific method. So we are going to now start running experiments. So based on what I've learned from my seeing step, I'm going to now start, maybe I start thinking about what's appropriate here, or start thinking about doing things differently than I have in the past. Maybe I start by doing nothing. That's one of my favorites, because I'm a professional fixer and I tend to be somewhat reactive. So learning to simply do nothing when I'm not quite sure what to do has been huge with my kids, because it's often given them the space to solve the problem themselves. And see, this is one of the critical problems with today's intensive parenting, is we tend to jump in and fix things for our kids so quickly that we get in the way of their ability to learn skills. So at every age, this has worked with my kids, not every time, of course, but, you know, maybe they'll calm down. Maybe they'll solve a fight with each other. You know, maybe they'll come back to me and apologize, which it feels like a miracle. That's amazing, right? But that doesn't happen if I don't give them a little space. So maybe I start something and it works. Great. What I've done now is I've gained a successful data point. So I'm going to file that away and say that worked. And it's very important to understand what that worked means in SciSee Start. It means that worked today with this kid in this situation. And that's important, because depending on how exhausted you are or your child is, or depending on the environment, something that works well one time may not work the next, but that's okay. We're learning. Sometimes we start something and it backfires. And then we go right back into that internal should storm and we say, oh, I should have done it differently. Look how I messed up as a mother. Well, we know what to do when we feel the shoulds. We sigh, see, and start again. So what we are doing is, number one, we're gathering skills very quickly compared to the way we do when we're preoccupied with the shoulds. But the other thing is, with continued use, parents tell me that it radically changes their relationship with their own perfectionism and with their kids. So instead of now focusing on, I've got to get it right, I'm focusing on, what am I learning? What am I trying? What's working? What's not working? It's not a crisis if it doesn't work, because I learned something. That's great. And if we show up with that kind of like, I'm here, I'm paying attention, and I'm learning, and I'm growing along with you, and we show up like that to our kids, that suddenly gives them space now to say, hey, it's okay. I'm not, maybe I won't get in huge trouble if I make a tiny little mistake, right? Or maybe I can try things out like a kid should, and it's okay. So that's what I love about this method.
I think what resonates the most with me is the fundamental difference that this has compared to I think maybe other approaches. And you said something very, very critical that I want to point out. When something works, it works in this moment with this kid in this situation. And I find that parents tend to have unrealistic expectations for some kind of fix or approach or should that needs to work all the time, right? They want something all the time. How do you break up a fight, right? How do you convince your kids to, you know, get off devices? How do you navigate a child who doesn't want to do homework, right? Sibling rivalry, etc. They want one answer and one approach. And what you're saying is that that doesn't exist. And you just have to keep collecting data. So you are overwhelmingly, right, have that positive slope and you're going in the right direction, but your approach may change each time. And more importantly, that's okay.
And I think that one of the emphases that we get into in the book is the emphasis of SciC START approach to parenting is not getting perfect behavior out of our kids. It's building that genuine trusting relationship, and it's enhancing our kids' skills in their ability to make good decisions. So I grew up under old school parenting. Grew up in a conservative religious family, lots of corporal punishment, lots of verbal shaming. Most kids I knew got that kind of parenting too, whether they were religious or not. And, you know, there was such a belief and it was so strong, which is this is loving. This is what we need to do. Because if you spare the rod, you spoil the child, right? But the problem is that that kind of parenting, and it's the way my parents were raised and their parents too, was it taught us to stuff our emotions and to comply, right? And so many parents get now to today and they say, I've had to do a lot of work to recognize my emotions. Like, you know, my kids set me off and I didn't know I had that in me. And people, like a lot of us are learning how to regulate our own emotions because of the way we were raised so that we can also teach that to our kids. And I truly believe that there is a way to be a parent who has authority. You know, we pediatricians talk a lot about healthy parenting being authoritative. So it's warm, nurturing, but also I'm in charge, right? And you can trust that I'll be in charge and that's going to give you a sense of security. And so there's a way to do that without having to spank your kids with a big board, you know? But when you do that, you end up with messier behavior because now the focus is not on getting that behavior to look good. That focus is on us building skills together because I'm learning to regulate my emotions. You're learning to regulate your emotions. And why do I focus on emotional regulation? Because we tend to make good decisions when we can calm ourselves down. That's why. It's not because we need, I'm not going with the should storm. The should storm says we have to feel good all the time. No, not at all. Negative emotions actually are very valuable to us. It's that when we learn how to interact with our emotions and not see them as dangerous or a problem, then we can learn to make really good critical decisions. And that's a skill we want our kids to have so that when they're out of our house, they can make those decisions wisely in the real world.
So, and I actually think that's the second fundamental change, right? So the first of that is that your approach doesn't have one specific way of doing something. It sort of relies on parents' own intuition and a component of trial and error. And the second thing, which I think is super critical, is that your approach doesn't try to achieve a certain behavior. And I find that that's also an unrealistic expectation that parents have, right? They are very laser focused on one behavior, whether it's potty training, whether it's, you know, a certain way that they want their kids to come home and do homework or interact with others. And you're saying, no, that's not the goal. The goal should be to have a loving relationship that grows with you and with your child and for your child to develop some skills by themselves, which I think is different.
And I think, you know, when I first started sharing this method with parents, I expected the results to be long-term. Like I expected parents mm-hmm. to have to buy in for a while to start seeing results because as pediatricians, we know how human development works. It's messy. There's ups and downs. You gain skills over years, not over days, right? And then I had parents coming back and telling me that they were seeing radical changes within 2 weeks. And I'm like, oh, okay. So because humans are made to really connect with each other. So when parents start connecting mindfully with their children, they will start to see positive behavior change more quickly. You know, a lot of childhood misbehavior is really about trying to get mommy and daddy to actually pay attention. And we're so distracted attention. These days, right? And Sigh, See, Start doesn't take long. Once you practice it a bit, you know, at first it might take 30 seconds, but it becomes second nature. It becomes a 1 second, 2 second thing for people, you know? So I've just been so pleasantly surprised by how well it works for people. But the other thing I just wanted to say, what you said about specific behaviors, where's that coming from? That's coming from a culture that says, if you don't potty train your kid, then you're a failure as a parent. And not only are you a failure now, but you're probably going to fail all the way down the road. And your child it's going to have a terrible life in the future because you couldn't achieve breastfeeding. You couldn't achieve potty training or whatever, right? And that's so unfair, especially because as pediatricians, we see the gamut of kids with different developmental trajectories. You know, boys with ADHD notoriously potty train much later, right? And like they don't have a diagnosis yet and their parents feel like big failures. And it's like, it's not their fault. It's okay. You know, we're learning as we can, right? And to set these kinds of one size fits all rules on people and expectations of what makes you a good parent or not based on your child's behavior is radically unfair to both parent and child. So when you sigh, see, and start, suddenly your focus is different. You have more time to really enjoy your child. And you stop worrying about whether you're a good parent or not so much, because it's about just trying to learn together with your child. And suddenly you start to feel like a good parent, which is really great.
I do want to recognize that I think it's difficult to do, right? I want to like point out that this is not an easy shift that we're recommending people make, because the should storm is very powerful. Let's even take our potty training example. How many parents, right, have come to us and say, the school that I do send my child to next year says they'll only take them in this class if they're potty trained. So that's what we need to achieve, right? That this is sort of like I always tell people, this is an arbitrary thing. This is like a school problem. It's not a you problem. It's not a kid problem. But I think that the should storm is very powerful, whether that expectation is coming from schools or from grandparents or from your social circle, where maybe everybody else that age is already potty trained or whatever, eats their broccoli or doesn't fight with their kid or with their sibling, right? So I want to recognize that the shift that we're asking people to make is not an easy one.
No. And, you know, I have my own regrets as a mom around that, because my son was in a daycare. My first son was in a daycare where, you know, he couldn't move to the 3-year-old room unless he was potty trained. So he was in the 2-year-old room and, you know, all his friends moved to the 3-year-old room. And I knew better. I was a pediatrician. I had studied child development. I understood a lot about potty training. I knew better. I knew it could cause harm to my son to force him to potty train. And guess what I did?
You potty train. We all did.
I did it.
We all did.
I did it because I was so afraid of him getting left in the 2-year-old room and not moving up to the 3-year-old room. And he did potty train, but then he led to some of the predictable. Problems like, you know, a half a year, a year later that you and I see in the pediatric office, you know, and moments like that were formative for me, because it's hard. It's hard as any parent. It's hard for me to have written a book like that. You know, I ask myself very often, is this arrogant? Is this really helpful? Or am I just, you know, I don't want to add to the should storm for people, right? But fundamentally, we need something, because these kinds of situations happen all the time. Now, with my second son, I said, there's no way I'm doing that. So we researched and we went to a daycare that was a little bit farther drive. And so it did make our commute harder, but just because that daycare had an appropriate developmental attitude and had a transitional room for kids who were 3 or 4 who hadn't fully potty trained yet.
So listen, I mean, you were collecting data, right? So to put you sort of in a position where you shouldn't have any regrets about it, you were collecting data, and you know, We learn, we grow.
Wow, you know, thank you. No one said that to me, and I realized I'm still holding this guilt, but you're right. I was collecting data, but fundamentally, and that's the important thing that I want to say to all parents is we're all doing the best we can with what we know at the time, right? And sometimes
Right.
for parents, addressing this can feel a little painful at first because they can be like, oh my gosh, I really have been caught up in this should storm, and you know, I've missed opportunities with my kids. But you know, culture is a powerful thing. And if that's the message from everywhere, what are you going to do? Right? You do the best you can. And there's always time to shift a relationship with our kids, even if they're in adulthood.
I actually think that's a very powerful statement where we always say, like, it's not too late, it's not too late. But somebody might be listening and maybe they have teenage kids, right? Where the potty training example doesn't apply to them, or even adult kids. And they feel like, oh gosh, like, you know, when I was raising my kids, it was all about the should, and it was all about this, whether it was attachment or critical parenting or whatever, intensive parenting. And now they're feeling like the ship has sailed. But you're saying, no, that's never ever the case.
No, I a large part of my practice over the years has involved working with people with trauma histories, working with parents with their own trauma histories, with you know, like trauma growing up with parents that didn't abusive parents or things like that, you know, and fundamentally every child longs, no matter how old they are. We all long for that relationship with our parent, but sometimes it's not possible to have unless that parent comes and says, "Hey, I've had this insight recently, and I realize I may have blown it here, and I want to bring that to you, and I want to apologize." Right? There's actually in a section in Sisee Start in the book on how to apologize and how to apologize using Sisee Start, because that's something I encourage from the youngest ages, and it's something I did as soon as my kids could speak, right? If I felt I blew it, I would say, you know, I would hold myself to the same account that I held them. So if they were responsible to not scream nasty things at other people, then I'm responsible for that too. And so I would say to them, you know, mommy's sorry I said that. Please forgive me. And as I got older, I would use the more structured apology, which is acknowledging what you've done, not making excuses for it, acknowledging the impact that may have had on the other person, and asking them to say, like, I imagine that made you feel bad or sad or mad. You know, do you want to tell me how that made you feel? Because I really want to make things right between us, you know? Or I imagine that made you feel afraid of mommy, and maybe you don't want to trust mommy as much. And I understand that. And so I was wondering if we could talk about that because I would like to make that right. And so in child development circles, we call that repair.
I want to emphasize that this is a very powerful tool. I apologized to my 2-year-old recently, obviously not this whole full structured, but you know, I recognized that I made a mistake and I apologized. And he absolutely knew what was going on. And he absolutely, I think it for sure repaired. I don't know, you know, obviously did not undo my action, but I do think it's very powerful. And it's a tool that I think it's difficult, not easy. It's never easy to apologize, but I think it's a tool that we should all probably be using more frequently. I think this is a good lead into my final question, which is about this concept of a perfect parent. And I think that's something that maybe people see as the ultimate goal, but this whole concept of trial and error and gathering data and apology tells me that that's not a thing. So what do you see as sort of like this goal of a perfect parent, and why is it a dangerous one to have?
Well, the current in vogue version of the perfect parent is really, I think you see it in where things have gone, because the current parenting big fad is called gentle parenting. And like most of these in vogue parentings, there's some wonderful aspects to gentle parenting. In fact, I've been called a gentle parenting ass expert. What gentle parenting looks like for most parents is this expectation that they are going to be emotionally calm and regulated all the time in a perfect way. And then they're going to educate their child about their own, their child's emotions and get and they have to co-regulate. So they have to get their child to then feel regulated and making good decisions, right? And so in SciSee Start the Book, we talk about co-regulation, right? But co-regulation, where it becomes something we have to do all the time, suddenly becomes this invasive type of parenting where we're constantly in the child's space trying to fix them, because if they're not in the right state, then we're not good parents, right? So that's not healthy. So let's imagine we had a mother like that, okay? So she's perfectly poised and warm and nurturing all the time, you know, and when she uses her authority, she does it always with perfect assertion, but without being aggressive, and she never loses her stuff, right? She never shames us, and we don't want that.
Yeah.
But what happens when a child grows up, let's say that person existed, which they do not, but let's say they did, the child is going to grow up with a sense of deep inadequacy, because the child cannot ever match that mother, right? The child messes up. The child blows it. The child makes mistakes, but their mother doesn't. And their mother always understands what they need at a perfect level, because that's part of what we expect of mothers now, is to meet everybody's needs emotionally, physically, spiritually, academically.
At all times,
and with profound intuition to perfectly know, right? So, you know, when you grow up with God and that kind of perfection, you end up feeling very small and inadequate, right? And so that's what happens. And then this child would also grow up then with their needs always being perfectly met instantly. Suddenly, they have not, they're going to hit the real world and realize they haven't developed any tools to manage, right? Because the rest of the world isn't going to act like that. So your child now can't manage without mom, right? They haven't developed independence. And so we are set within human families to be raised by humans so that we can grow up as humans. And humans are not perfect. We are, you know, we get dysregulated, we get tired, we get stressed, you know, we say things we regret. And when our parents do that and don't always intuitively know all our needs all the time, we then have opportunities to learn the skills for ourselves. And if we can be loving parents who are focusing enough on our child to be working with them on that, but not perfect to where they're not, you know, we're not meeting their needs instantly all the time, we're giving them a loving space to learn the skills they're going to need in life. So it's actually better to have a less than perfect parent.
I love that. I think that just, that's so validating. And I think overwhelmingly, hopefully good news for people, because this goal of trying to achieve perfect parenting doesn't exist, nor should it. So I love that. Listen, I want to thank you so much. This was amazing. I want to ask you one final question, probably not related to anything that we talked about, but maybe it is. I asked this to most of my guests who are physicians. If you had to pick one thing in your field, that's a preventative health step, right? So for example, I had a trauma surgeon. I said, if you could pick one thing that people can do to like prevent being patients of yours, what would you pick? And I think she said helmets. So as a pediatrician, if there was like one big thing that you could share, if you could tell patients like do this one thing to stay healthy or and to prevent illness, what would it be?
Well, at the risk of creating another should, I would encourage parents to not throw in the towel on striving to maintain some kind of screen time limits with your kids. We need kids to have enough time off their screens that they're interacting with the real world and other people. And I know the schools make it challenging. The schools where I'm have made it extremely hard because my kids have Chromebooks, you know. But all too many parents in exhaustion, and because frankly it cuts down on the fighting if the child is allowed to just have unlimited screen time. And unfortunately, the science is just mounting on the effects of that, you know. So not to get wordy, but there's a lot of studies that'll say, hey, you know, video games actually build certain kinds of skills, so that's great. But overall, the effect of screen time is that kids don't socialize as much and they have more relationship with their screens. And so that is leading to more and more being connected to the mental health crisis we're seeing, to the crisis of loneliness and anxiety in our children. So fight the good fight. I know I'm fighting it with my high schooler and it is worse.
It's not easy. It's not easy. It's not easy at any age.
Yeah.
And just like everything else we talked about, it's an ongoing sort of, you know, it's ongoing work. It's ongoing work and it's not easy. I don't want anyone to think that what we're saying, what we're recommending is easy, but I think ultimately it's worth it.
And in good size C start fashion, the correct screen time limit is going to vary by kid to kid and their current needs. So.
Sure. And the AEP, by the way, quick plug, right, for the AEP is that they have a media use toolkit, which I think I've used a few times in my household, where you kind of like revise, right, the contract and you have a conversation with your kids and it should be, you know, shared decision making and all of that. And I find that especially school age kids and older kids are really receptive to that because they feel like they're part of the discussion, but they also have some parental limits, right, where that sort of like guide what the cutoffs are going to be for each kid in each situation. And yeah, it's not easy.
You know, speaking of shared decision making, that's one of the hardest things for a lot of parents to figure out how to do without giving up their authority. And so there's actually a whole chapter in SciC Start on that as well.
Amazing. Well, thank you once again. This was, I think, a very cool episode that hopefully everyone else will enjoy as well.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the JOMA podcast. We welcome your feedback and ideas for future episodes. Send us an email at health@joma.org. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast platform.